Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. I'm David Bowes, your host. A new study in Nature claims that science can predict the extent to which a clade, a group of organisms that includes all descendants from a common ancestor, will form new species. The researchers examined cichlids in 46 African lakes and concluded, quote, that the probability of diversification, or adaptive radiation, depends on a combination of environmental factors and sexual selection. African cichlids are particularly suitable for this type of study because of the extremely high species richness that developed over time from what was originally a small number of species in large African lakes. For Lakes Victoria and Malawi alone, more than 800 endemic cichlid species have been recorded. Unquote. But what are these new species really like? What constitutes a new species and how are they determined? And what are the implications for evolutionary theory and intelligent design? Here to talk about it with me is the Discovery Institute's Casey Luskin. Casey, what did this study actually find out?
What it basically found out is that you can predict the number of species that will develop within a group or a clade based upon the amount of living space that is available within that clade's niche, and also based upon the prevalence of sexually selected traits, things like different coloration between males and females. And essentially what it said is that these types of factors, the amount of living space that's out there, in this case with cichlids, the amount of space in the lakes that there is, and also coloration differences, can lead to the origin of new species within this group.
So what do these new species look like? What differentiates them from the species they come from?
Well, that's the key point, Dave, because a lot of these species are, on a morphological level, almost identical. As a matter of fact, you might even say they are virtually indistinguishable. I remember that back in college, I wrote a paper on cichlid speciation for an upper division evolutionary biology course I was taking, and I had to investigate the actual differences between these separate, quote-unquote, species of cichlids. And I studied one genus of cichlids, which found that the differences between the two species had to do only with the fact that one group tended to stay in the upper 20 meters or so of lake water, and another would go a little bit deeper. And so essentially, when you look at these two species, they looked almost exactly the same. They just happened to traverse slightly different depths of the lake. And as a result, they tended not to interbreed. And so by the biological species concept definition of a species, they were, quote unquote, separate species. That didn't say anything about whether or not they were actually morphologically different or that any real non-trivial amount of evolution had taken place.
What are the implications for evolutionary theory, having made this observation that they can predict the speciation based on basically the availability of habitat?
Well, you know, I am sure that this study is perfectly fine and good, and they can predict the prevalence of a group to undergo speciation, so long as you recall that they are using a definition of species, which simply means a reproductively isolated population of organisms. And we need to keep in mind that that definition says nothing about the degree of morphological, behavioral, or genetic change that has taken place. In fact, that definition of species doesn't necessarily imply that any significant biological change has taken place between the two populations. So in many cases, two populations might be termed different species under the biological species concept, yet the differences between the populations are really quite small scale and trivial. So I don't necessarily have any reason to doubt the basic findings of this study. We just have to keep in mind that finding that a group can undergo speciation does not necessarily demonstrate that large-scale evolutionary change can occur.
Yeah, as a layperson, when I look at a headline that talks about the ability to create new species, that there's this predictive evolution to create new species, I think of something much more radical than this one fish lives at one level of the lake and another set of fish live at a different level of the lake and they no longer breed together. Does that mean they can't breed together or that they don't?
Well, I don't know these specific fish if they can breed together, say, in captivity. The biological species definition pertains to what goes on in the wild. So if in the wild they don't breed together because they happen to live at slightly different depths in the lake, then that, by the biological species concept definition, that is a different species. But it's entirely possible that maybe you put a male and a female in a tank and maybe they'll like each other and maybe something will happen there. I'm not sure exactly what's the case for these particular species in that kind of an environment. but that's not important. The fact that you could interbreed in captivity still could mean you're separate species in the wild.
So what did they think the implications for evolutionary theory were based on this study, and why was it important to them?
Well, they're trying to predict and understand why certain groups tend to be very rich in species diversity, whereas other clades are not very rich in species diversity. There's only a couple species of elephants on the face of the planet, but we have hundreds of species of cichlid fish. Why is that? Well, it has a lot to do with, according to this study, as we talked about, the amount of living space that's available to those organisms and also sexually selective traits. I think the sexually selected traits bit has a lot to do with the fact that you can very quickly establish reproductively isolated populations if you only like to mate with organisms that have a certain look or a certain features or certain behaviors. That can result in a new species quite rapidly. And so that's maybe an easy way to achieve speciation in the wild. But the bottom line here is they want to understand why certain groups have more species than others. They're not really asking any questions about whether large-scale, non-trivial biological change can arise by Darwinian evolution. And I think that that's something to keep in mind. And as you rightly mentioned, Dave, a lot of lay people will hear stories like this, read about studies like this, and think that they are finding that speciation is very common and that serious large-scale evolutionary change could take place. But that's not, in fact, what this kind of a study shows.
So the overall impact on the intelligent design theory is?
Intelligent design has never said that you cannot achieve a reproductively isolated population in nature. I think that some ID theorists have looked at claims of speciation and have wanted to say, well, how strong is the evidence really? Jonathan Wells wrote about this quite a bit in his book, Politically Incorrect Guide to Darwinism and Intelligent Design. Earlier in 2012, I put out a research paper called Specious Speciation that looked at a lot of claims of speciation and found that really they were not conclusory in the end, and that the evidence for speciation in nature is a lot weaker than we're often told it is. That having been said, I think we're open to the idea that a reproductively isolated population could be achieved by natural means. I don't have any problem with that whatsoever. The problem I have is when people equate or equivocate over what a speciation event means, and they imply that speciation means that large-scale evolutionary change must have taken place, when in fact, when you define a species as merely a reproductively isolated population, that does not at all imply that large-scale evolutionary change has occurred. And a lot of evolutionists will sort of use those terms in a slippery way and not make those distinctions clear. And I just think it's important for critical thinkers out there to understand what is really meant by speciation and what is not necessarily meant by speciation.
Is there any similarity here between the observations made about the cichlids and the observation Darwin made about the size of finch beaks?
Well, yeah, I think that there is something to make comparison here. Obviously, you can look at, and actually, correction there, David, and don't worry, this is a very, very common misconception. Darwin did not really look at the finches on the Galapagos Islands. He looked at mockingbirds, and a lot of textbooks today get this wrong. Mm. They say that Darwin went to the Galapagos Islands and studied the finches when, in fact, he looked at the Galapagos mockingbirds, which are even more similar than the Galapagos finches are. But the bottom line is, in the case of the Galapagos finches, yes, across the various Galapagos Islands, there are some 13 or 14 species of finches. When you look at them, many of them are virtually identical, and they can interbreed in captivity. And yet, because they are reproductively isolated in nature, they're considered to be separate species. So biology textbooks will use these as examples of the power of evolution to create new species, never mentioning the fact that after 13 or 14 million years of evolution, which is supposedly how long ago the common ancestor of these finches reached the Galapagos Islands, these finches are almost all still virtually identical in most respects and can still interbreed. So again, you have an example of, yes, is it speciation by the definition of a reproductively isolated population? Yes. Is it an example of non-trivial, large-scale biological change? No. And in that respect, it's very similar to the case of the cichlids.
Casey Luskin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That concludes this edition of ID the Future. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting the work of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Go to idthefuture.com and click the donate button. This podcast is copyright 2012, the Discovery Institute. All rights reserved.